Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Well, today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Michael Hickens. He is the author of a recently published book titled Bloomquist. Set in 11th century Europe, Bloomquist traces the course of human history in matters that are relevant today. In this conversation, we will be touching on history, cultures, and religion. And I promise you, it's going to be interesting. But before we talk to Michael, I'd like you to know a little bit about him. Michael Hickens is the author of the critically acclaimed short story collection, The Actual Adventures of Michael Missing. His own subsequent adventures include helping his wife run an American eatery in La Rochelle, France, and becoming an editor at the Wall Street Journal. His writing includes an essay on foot fetishism, In Dirty Words, a Literary Encyclopedia of Sex, and the novel Bloomquist, which we're going to be talking about today. Excerpts from the What Do You Know contest have been published in literary magazines such as Monkey Bicycle and Sententia. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Irene.
Well, this is great to be talking to you. And just before we really get into some really interesting stuff that we're going to talk about, I just want you to give our listening audience just a brief outline or a description of what your book, Bloomquist, is about.
Bloomquist is a Norman Viking, which is to say he lives in the 11th century in what's now called Normandy in France. He's a fiercely independent guy who doesn't have any ties to either any lords or religions, and by lords I mean secular lords. Like Lord of the Manor. He basically goes on an adventure to rescue his betrothed, who's been kidnapped. Along the course of this adventure, he encounters different peoples from different areas in the Mediterranean basin. The book is structured very much like a Renaissance picaresque novel, where it sort of ends where it begins, but in the meantime, he goes to Italy, the Adriatic, Turkey, Italy, Spain, and back to Normandy. And in the course of those adventures, as I said, encounters all of these different kinds of people and has mostly very violent collisions with those people.
So I'm very curious. There are very few books recently been written in for that era. And so I'm very curious in knowing why you chose to write about the 11th century.
I think it came out of a desire on my own part to sort of understand why we have such a clash of cultures right now in our world, principally between Oriental and Occidental, between Christian and non-Christian, and Muslim in particular, and sort of to seek out the roots of that. And in doing that, I discovered that not only has there been this chasm between Christian and non-Christian, but even between Western Christian and Eastern Christian, and it sort of informed a lot of the historical basis around why I chose that particular moment. I also found that that moment was incredibly rich in history that we don't really know about. Robert Guiscard is one of my favorite characters in the book. He comes in relatively late. He represents somewhat of almost our own Gilded Age, where here's a guy who didn't have a lot of opportunities where he was born. So he was the seventh son of a manor lord, and so he had to defer to his siblings. And so he basically took a small army and he went and invaded Italy, and occupied Sicily, occupied parts of Syracuse, and he was very powerful. He titled himself an emperor, and it's people like him who are responsible for the fact that there are blondes in Italy because of that history. So I found, you know, in search of one answer, I found so many different things. I thought, well, what a rich period to write about.
No kidding. So in your research, what did you find that was the main reason for, let's say, these clashes that were actually happening in, let's say, in Christianity?
Well, I have a pretty cynical view about that, and I think that it mostly was opportunistic on the part of the wealthy noble classes. It was a power struggle, pure and simple. I don't think that there was. I think that the actual schism between the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church were over something called the Filioque, which was a certain decree by the Vatican on a very minor philosophical or religious dispute that the Orthodox Church didn't sign on to, and that's the nominal reason. But I think that really the roots are economic and political.
Mm-hmm. Even though under the guise of religion.
Right.
Yeah, is what you feel. Now, it seems to me from anything that I have read, too, I got the impression that it was a very man-made religion, and it was, at that time, governed by man.
That's right.
And so, why do you think that is?
Yeah. Well, there were some incredibly powerful women. Now, they sometimes didn't last very long, but I think that that could be said of some of the men who rose to power as well. It was a very violent and turbulent time. Oddly enough, I remember reading about one woman who was very briefly wrote the Holy Roman Emperor. She lasted less than a year, and she had her eyes put out, which seems incredibly barbaric to us and is. But at the time, it was a very common and considered an actually humane way to dispose with a political rival, because you didn't actually kill them. You just rendered them totally ineffective. So there were a lot of, in fact, Robert Guiscard, my character, his wife is an incredibly powerful person in reality as well. So there were, but you're right. I mean, for the most part, as I think, mostly today, power is in the hands of men.
Yes, it is. And, some of the specifically Christian religions do allow women to be pastors or ministers or, lead a congregation, but there are still some that do not allow women, for instance, Catholicism.
Right. That's absolutely correct. And I think that it also depends on who is practicing or who's enforcing which particular codes of the religion, because even if you look at the Jewish community, there are different interpretations within them about the role of women.
And they're all right. They all think they're right.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. In your research also, Michael, what are some of the interesting things that you found out in the clashes in cultures specifically, not necessarily religion, but in cultures?
Well, it was very amusing to find that that an epithet that that people use was "this is unheard of," and "this is not customary," and those were real fighting words. I mean, today you say, "oh, that's unheard of," and you think, "gee, who drinks Pepsi with a straw?" But in those days, "that's unheard of" was almost like saying, "you have just practiced incest with your mother."
Hmm.
And people were very inflexible and had very little experience with people that they weren't very familiar with. And in fact, I think that there's a sense of individuality now that didn't exist at the time. It was much more of a hive thing, and so you sort of fell in with your town. And you did whatever was customary for your town. And if the town next door did something different, you literally wanted to kill them. And so I think that the idea of foreignness was a very frightening and threatening thing at the time.
So, it's interesting as you're saying this, and I'm sort of thinking back, and there's just, in that era, there was just so much violence, so much fighting going on. And, on the other hand, is it really any different now, maybe, in some of the countries? But I guess that's probably the only way that they could get power and control was physically fighting and being violent.
Well, and I mean, I think that your point is very interesting in that I don't think things are that different today. And I think that I picked that period particularly because I didn't want to make a point about any one particular group of people today.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want to point fingers and say, you know, you people are responsible for the violence, or, you know, you people are less tolerant than others. And so I wanted to look at a more, you know, universally human condition, which is that of tolerance versus intolerance. And I think that was one of the things that surprised me as well, and that I wanted to show in this novel, was that individual human beings, when given the chance, could be remarkably tolerant, remarkably open-minded. It was the purview, I think, of people who were privileged in one way or another, either because they were born into great wealth, or if they were supremely talented in some way, such as strength.
Uh-huh.
Blomqvist's greatness lies almost principally in the fact that he's a really big guy. And actually, if you look at the times, like, for instance, in reality, Charlemagne was a giant.
Yes.
Well over 6 foot tall. All of the great leaders of that period, most of them had enormous size advantages. And there's this kind of sense that you're drawn to people like that because they can protect you. And they can protect you because whereas it will exhaust a normal guy to hold a very big sword and swing it 3 or 4 times,
yeah,
a really big guy can swing his sword 20 or 25 times, and a much bigger sword, and a sword made of heavier metal that will pierce armor, et cetera, et cetera. So size was a very important thing. So if you had that kind of talent, you could rise above, and then you had the luxury of sort of thinking about your life. And one of the passages, which is narrated by Blomqvist's amanuensis, his standard bearer, Axel, Axel Oxenstierna, Axel actually says, you know, we didn't think of ourselves as individuals, right? We didn't think, what about me?
Mm-hmm.
We just did. Blomqvist is his hero in part because Blomqvist thinks, what about me? And that makes him a very unique individual, and that's why I wanted to write about him.
Michael, did in research for your book, did you actually go to Sweden? Did you go to Italy to see what's really, you know, get the feel of the community, the culture?
I've spent a lot of time in Europe, and I'm pretty familiar with a lot of the areas that that I write about. And one of the great joys, actually, of the research was discovering a diary of a notary in Bruges, who was there at the time of the assassination of Charles the Good, which is one of the early sequences in the novel. I borrowed very liberally from his from his notes of the time, and took note of the way he referenced things like something was unheard of. And, for instance, murdering somebody was not unheard of course. In fact, there were days that were prescribed. The manor lords would get together and say, okay, there's to be no killing on Thursdays. And so Thursdays, there was no killing. You could kill every other day. But...
yeah.
There were things like, if you killed someone within their own home, the penalty was twice if you killed them outside their home, and you weren't allowed to kill people inside their home when it was dark outside. So it was a
perception
of what murder is and what the penalties for it are. I found that fascinating.
That is fascinating, and it just brought to, you know, because it's just these laws that they obviously created for some reason. There was a reason that they needed to do that. And what just came to mind is, like, I think, you know, I'm here in Texas, and there's a law that you can't spit on the sidewalk. I mean, that doesn't really even affect anymore because our culture doesn't really spit on sidewalks. But back then when the law first came in, which was, you know, there were a lot of cowboys around, and they did spit because that was the thing to do, you know, chewing tobacco and you spit. And so it's interesting that, you know, what you said, you can't kill on Thursday. So, yeah, it's all very cultural, isn't it? The Normans, the Vikings, were wanderers, weren't they? They, you know, they didn't stay put, and it seemed that they just moved.
Well, they were. I wouldn't call them wanderers. I'd say that they were more like traveling salespeople. But they were traveling salespeople, you know, with swords and catapults and such. They were a pretty frightening bunch. They actually sailed their ships off the Atlantic into France on the Seine and the Somme, and burned Paris down, burned Walt down, and then they would threaten to do it again unless they were, you know, they were paid ransom, which was called Danegeld, because they were from Denmark, and geld is money, and Dane obviously is. So they demanded ransom in exchange for not burning the town down again, and they usually got it. And then some of them would settle nearby because they thought it was nice countryside.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today we're talking with Michael Pickens, author of Bloomquist. I'm sure you found this. This is a really interesting conversation. And you know what? It's even going to get more interesting as we chat further. We may even get to answer the question, why are we here? So stay tuned. You know, this is all just very fascinating, and I'm sure that you just really thoroughly enjoy doing the research and then, of course, writing about it. I just want to go back a little bit about religion, because that seems to be sort of, you know, an important part of your book, too. And there just seems to be so much hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we teach about love, and then we kill people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what do you make of all that?
Well, you know, I'd like to just point out that Bloomquist himself asks that question a number of times, and, you know, very bitterly and sarcastically chides the Christians with whom he's allied at one point, and teases them about the fact that they claim to, you know, be defending brotherly love, and yet they're slaughtering each other for wealth. And I do think that and you know the flip side of that, of course, because I mean to reveal my own feelings about it, I mean I share Bloomquist's sense of skepticism about the whole thing, but Axel is desperately in search of the comfort that real religion and real spirituality can bring. It's interesting. I discovered another thing which I found very interesting. When the Christians destroyed the temple in Uppsala, which was in Norway, it essentially shattered the illusion that that those peoples had about their Norse gods. And it's, you know, we refer to that as Norse mythology. We talk about Greek mythology. To them, that was religion. And maybe in, you know, 1,000 years, people will look back at our Christian mythology as well, or our Jewish mythology.
Right.
So, you know, to them it was very real, only if your gods are so weak that the worshippers of some other god can come along and destroy your temple, then you're not really very useful. And at the time, I think religion was a very purposeful thing. You didn't have very much in this life, and it was a pretty hard life. To quote Hobbes, it was short, nasty, and brutish. And or to misquote him, I'm sure you get the point. So for Axel, it was really important to figure out which religion he could glom onto. You know, is it Catholicism, or maybe, mm-hmm. oh, these at least two Orthodox people seem to have this other idea. Oh, wait a minute, these Muslims seem to have another idea. These Hindus, these Jews, they all have these different things to bring, and which one should I pick?
Mm-hmm.
And that's his quest. So, I mean, you know, they have two different quests. Right? Blomqvist is trying to rescue, quote-unquote, his betrothed, and Axel knows full well that one day Blomqvist is going to die. As long as Blomqvist is alive, he's fine. He's protected. And that's all he wants. But once Blomqvist is dead, then what? What becomes of him now, and perhaps what comes after him, what becomes of him in the hereafter? And that's his quest. And so I think that for Axel, and to your question specifically, I think that we're still, attracted to religion and spirituality because we sense our own fragility and we're looking to somehow be connected to something larger than ourselves, not only as a, you know, sort of afterlife kind of thing, but really even in the here and now, mm-hmm. and in the today, we would like to feel like our lives mean something. And it's a sort of a very evolved, I think, kind of impulse. What organized religion does to that, however, in my estimation, is, you know, take advantage of that for very different purposes.
Michael, am I right that back in when the Normans were in existence, they were pagans, were they not?
Yes.
Okay.
They were.
And so when you did your research, what did you find that was interesting about their belief, the pagan belief, that was unlike Christianity or, you know, any of the others that were eventually came in?
So first of all, I just want to point out, I'm sorry, I actually, the Normans themselves, well, I'm sorry, the Vikings themselves were mostly had that sort of Norse religion. The people that they conquered or lived amongst in Normandy were, many of them were Celts and others were Germanic. They had a much more animist view, so other living things had godlike qualities, very much like American Native Americans, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Very much tied to trees and other animals.
So, you know, in some definitions, that would be more spirituality than religion.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. This must have been extremely interesting for you to do all this research and then create it into a book. So when you were writing, and of course, this is fiction, but did you actually, and I think you did mention that you did take some of your own beliefs and actually put them in there and your own questions into the book. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, definitely.
And so just tell us some of the things that actually you put into the book that were from your own belief system.
Oh, well, I actually didn't put so much into my own belief system as I put in my own questions, if you will.
Which are? Tell us some of those questions.
Well, why? I guess, why are we here? Why? Why are we here?
Yeah.
You know, do we serve a higher purpose? What is the path to real enlightenment? One of the principal, I think that what I put of myself most into this story was the love story between Blomqvist and Alex, his betrothed.
Uh-huh.
Not to reveal too much, but Alex is herself a very complicated person who doesn't have a lot of appearances in the novel in her own right until the very end when she has a more prominent role. But she is someone who's struggling with the issue of how do I deal with men?
Mm.
Men who want to own me and control me. And how do I preserve my own sense of self? And that's a really important question to me. How do we love each other, and how do we give each other the space that we need? How do we coexist as a couple? And, you know, also, I mean, Blomqvist is driven by his love for this woman to extraordinary lengths. And that was something that was interesting for me to explore, just how far you would go, how much disappointment you're willing to put up with. Literally, how many boat rides, how many battles, how many imprisonments are you going to put up with to follow through to the very end? That to me was that was what I put the most of myself into in this novel.
Interesting. That would be some interesting reading, Michael. Why are we here? Why are we here? Yes.
I think we're here. Thanks to a fantastically improbable series of consequences, coincidences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we are here because we are in some way, the expression of the universe's will to live, that we are thus far the ultimate expression of some universal life force. And I think that we're here to help that life force figure out why it's here.
And what is our path to that enlightenment?
I think that the path to that enlightenment is to keep searching and to keep up with the quest.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that what the Normans did?
It is, and it's what Blomqvist did. And in fact, I mean, that's what his name means.
Oh.
His name really means, to me, Bloom's quest. And to me, the name Bloom, of course, is linked to James Joyce's Leopold Bloom in Ulysses, who himself is on a quest, an odyssey. To me, Bloom is a word that that holds very much an enormous amount of promise, right? Because there's the act of blooming in it. You have a bud and it blooms. And so I combined that blooming and quest into one word.
Michael, what is your quest?
I would love to tell the greatest story ever told.
Ah.
And I don't know what that is. So I keep telling stories, and I keep building on the stories that I tell in the hopes that one day I'll find out why we're here and what the greatest story that needs to be told is, and tell that story. In a sense, Blomqvist is a microcosm of my own quest that story.
What is your website address?
It's michaelmissing.com.
Michaelmissing.com. There you go, listeners. Hasn't it been interesting talking to Michael Hickens about his book, Blomqvist, and just all the research that he did and some of his own journey? And I just really encourage you to check this book out and see if it resonates with your own journey. I bet it will. I bet you will have some of those same questions that Blomqvist has too. So again, I encourage you. The author is Michael Hickens. The book is Blomqvist. Michael, thank you so much for showing up.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much.
This is Irene Watson for Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.